Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Many thanks to Patrick Maguire for looking after the place last week, but I'm back from my holidays. I'm not going to get into what I did while I was off, but I can assure you that it was unwise, but not illegal. Right, coming up on today's episode, we kickstart a brand new series. It's called The Exit Interviews. Already, 1 in 12 MPs have said they're going to stand down at the next election. So over the next few weeks, we're going to hear from some of them from across party and some who made the cabinet or backbenchers and talking about why they're quitting and some of the highs and lows, the best and worst bosses and that sort of thing. We kick off today with the former cabinet minister, George Eustace. Really, really fascinating chat about working with Dominic Cummings, being David Cameron's press secretary, arguing with Liz Truss when they were both in the cabinet. So that's coming up in just a moment. But as ever, we kick off with the columnist panel.
The Columnists with Libby Rachey, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester on Times Radio.
And Rachel Sylvester is here in the studio. Hello, Rachel.
Hi,
nice
Matt.
Nice to see you. And Libby Purvis is here. Morning, Libby.
Morning.
Here's a question. Is it fair for asylum seekers to have to share rooms? Last week, about 40 asylum seekers were offered space in a Pimlico hotel, but they refused to enter it after being asked to sleep four people per room. It's caused a big row. This is the Immigration Minister, Robert Jenrick, talked to the BBC about it yesterday.
It's right that we get good value for money for the taxpayer.
But I'm confused.
And so if single adult males can share a room, and it's legal to do so, which will obviously depend on the size of the accommodation, then we'll ask people to do that. And I think that's a completely fair and reasonable approach.
But we're talking about the broader...
I will never put the interests of migrants above those of the British public.
What do you think about this, Rachel? I mean, the thing I was quite surprised, I spent the weekend trying to find a hotel for three of us to stay in Bristol. Couldn't find one. So maybe Robert Jenrick could help out with that. But what do you think? Is it fair, or is this just a sort of another row the government's quite happy to have because we can hear them being tough?
I think that's true, but I think they're asking the wrong question here. I think the problem is that there's 170,000 people whose asylum applications haven't been processed. 130,000 have been waiting for 6 months or longer. So the system itself is broken. So if you end up not being able to get process people quickly enough, then you end up having to find hotels for them to live in, which is absurd. So given that that's the situation, as a short-term measure, I think it is legitimate to say that people could share. But the problem is they shouldn't be in the situation where they're having to be put up in hotels. So therefore, they shouldn't be having to share, big picture. And I think the other dimension to this is that I interviewed Andrew Mitchell, the International Development Minister, a few months ago, and he was pointing out that this all comes off his budget, that the international development budget is being raided by the Home Office, about 10%. 10% of it is going to the Home Office to pay for people to stay at this kind of accommodation for asylum seekers. And that means money isn't going to Africa and all the countries that need it for genuine humanitarian crises. But the problem here is that the government's allowed a completely dysfunctional system to develop. It's not whether people share rooms or not.
But then I suppose it's that's the thing, that they're happy to have the row about the sharing of the rooms, because it means we're not talking about how big the...
We'll get on and sort out the actual problem rather than having this row.
What do you think, Libby?
Well, I think Rachel said it all. I mean, I would wish them all to have actual beds, certainly, but there is this incredible backlog. I think it must be absolutely agonising not to be able to work, you know, to have made it over here and then not have any rights at all, not able to work, and then put in a room with three complete strangers. But I do wish we would work harder on the international European collaborations and ID cards here for work or rent. It would be a very small nuisance for existing citizens, and it would be a huge pull reduction, and nobody will talk about this in government. They're all just terrified that it'll be, oh, show me your papers, you know, fascist state and so on. But it need not be. But some form of identification. I mean, a number of people who say, oh, it's easy to work in England. We come to England because it's easy to work. We're not staying in France, you know, because we have identity. It's absurd that we don't look at this.
The other thing, I mean, talking about the system not working, this story by Matt Dathan in the Times today: illegal migration will have to fall dramatically to below 10,000 a year if Rishi Sunak's legislation to stop the boats is to be put into action. So this is the legislation which is in the House of Lords today. It's the one that Rishi Sunak's trumpeting in his speech in Kent. The illegal migration bill will give sweeping new powers to the government to automatically reject, detain and remove asylum seekers who arrive in the UK illegally. This is to send people to Rwanda. But it needs the 10,000 is the maximum number that Home Office officials believe the state can handle, which means they've got to cut the numbers by 80%.
So they're basically introducing a law which their own officials say can't work and isn't going to work in order to look tough for sort of political reasons. And I think there's another, it's back to your point about they want to have a row about this. I think they don't mind the fact that the House of Lords is going to rip this to shreds and point out all the flaws and block aspects of it, because then they can say, oh, you know, liberal elite peers have blocked our draconian proposals. You know, it's always blaming somebody else. And I think... Rishi Sunak wants to be seen as competent. He should deal with this in a sort of competent fashion rather than sabre-rattling.
What do you think, Libby? Because there's a risk, I think, that they're the ones who've put the small boats up in lights. They've turned it into a massive issue. It turns out they're actually far from running away from it. Keir Starmer's quite happy, it seems, to fight on this turf. This whole thing might end up backfiring on them, that they've highlighted a massive problem. They don't really have a workable solution to it, and they might end up paying a price rather than reaping any sort of political benefit.
I think they will, yes. I mean, the business of always blaming somebody else, finding somebody else to blame. Trevor Phillips has got a very good general column on that this morning, which takes us all the way from Schofield to Boris and beyond. I think it's political sabre-rattling, and it's going on both sides at the moment. And there is just not enough concentration on the absolute practical thing of getting more officials, getting the backlog cleared, you know, getting the pull factor down, working with Europe. We want action rather than this sort of grandstanding, which is what the bill seems at the moment to be all about.
Yeah, and it'll get bunged up at the House of Lords today, and they'll make some changes, and they'll go back to the Commons, and they'll have to row all over again. But, yeah, it's extraordinary, that story from Matt.
I sometimes think that the Brexiteers spent so many years blaming the EU for everything. Now, they haven't got the EU to blame. They have to blame everyone else.
Yes, the blob. It's all about the blob.
Exactly.
It's all about the blob. I mean, it's interesting.
It's all Gary Neville's fault.
If you look at the polling on which political party would be the best at handling asylum and immigration, don't know's top, according to YouGov. Then Labour just ahead of the Conservatives. But that the Tories have sort of picked up a bit, so actually maybe them banging away, maybe they think they've neutralised it as an issue without necessarily solving it. Let's turn to another bit of the state which doesn't seem to be working. Universities. And we've talked a lot. Before I was off, we talked about how the incredible story of students not getting their exams marked and not even getting degrees, which is incredible. Today, MPs are debating a petition calling for the creation of a statutory duty of care from universities towards students. It follows estimates that around 100 university students commit suicide every year.
And Libby, there's this big question about what is the relationship between universities and students? You know, they're paying a lot of money, but they don't seem to have any rights as a consumer in the way that if you're buying a car, you'd expect a car at the end of it. Do you think this should go further? Should there be a statutory duty to look after the well-being of students as well?
Well, if I may speak from the eons of the past, I went to university just after the age of majority was reduced to 18, and suddenly we were all considered to be adults. But there were still a lot of colleges around and dons around and principals around who considered that they had a bit of a loco parentis sort of responsibility for us. And this was actually quite sort of reassuring. Now what we have is 18-year-olds absolutely new to living away from home very often, having been highly protected by, you know, DBS checks and everything under the Children Act right up to the age of 18, they're cast with financial worries onto a completely new world, and it's considered entirely their own business if they take drugs or drink too much or sleep with everybody that they can find, and absolutely no sense that that there's any loco parentis in it at all. And so now we get back to this situation of saying, well, it's very hard, you know, they're very unprotected, they're all alone. Universities have a duty of care. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to actually give more sort of powers and responsibilities, adult responsibilities to universities? Or are we just going to be a bit more careful about the 18-year-olds who are loosed into this whole new world, you know, which is really difficult for many of them who've never been away from home at all before, and especially under the present sort of financial worries that they have and the cultural worries and the social media worries that they have. You know, it needs to be resolved. But as I say, it all really began when the loco parentis idea was dropped.
And actually probably the pandemic, Rachel, has made that worse, because so many lectures taking place virtually, you know, there's less of that sort of day-to-day interaction.
People are much more isolated. Yeah. So I think the universities do have a duty, and there's even sort of grey areas about whether they're allowed to ring the parents if they're worried about a student. But too often students just completely left to their own devices, and they do need support. But actually, I think the important thing is this needs to start much earlier in the education system. So at the moment, this kind of tick box exam focused system that we've got isn't creating resilient, well-rounded children who are then ready for university. So there needs to be much, it's about sort of doing things like drama and sport, things that build relationship, build sort of mental resilience and character and strength at school as well. The school system should be creating children who are ready to withstand going off to university without the need for support. And it just isn't. It's infantilizing children by, you know, you have to sit in rows, remember the facts, that's it. That's what school's about. And actually, school should be about creating adults of the future.
It's interesting, actually, when our eldest went from sort of GCSEs to A-levels, there was a big change at the sixth form where they said they wanted, you know, they wanted to be communicating much more with parents. It was the opposite of what I expected. I thought sort of secondary school would be much more like, you know, constant drip information. And they said, no, you have to be involved. I think the idea that you'd let 16 and 17-year-olds, you know, loose and it's all their own responsibility, they saw the value of sort of binding parents into knowing what was going on in that sort of communication, which just wasn't what I was expecting. Definitely isn't what I experienced. In fact, Paul Johnson, we'll speak to Paul. Go on, Libby.
I was just going to say, we had an experience of one of ours, our son, our late son, who at university at one stage, he said to me, I've decided that things don't connect to each other anymore. And I was worried about his state of mind. And because I happened to know a very nice tutor who was, I actually rang up and said, look, bothered about him. And the guy asked him to tea. Now, that's the kind of, you know, they're not supposed to tell you, but we told them, and he asked him to tea, and in fact, it was fine at the time, you know, it all settled down. But, you know, it's that degree of connection is something which universities are sort of told not to do. You know, they're told not to report to parents, not to speak to parents about someone looking a bit odd.
We spoke to Simon Wesley, the psychiatrist for the Education Commission, and he said he'd been to one Cambridge college where half the children were having counselling, you know, and he said, but the problem is, everything is being medicalised. So actually, a cup of tea and a chat and social interaction may be a much better solution than either some kind of antidepressants or even counselling. But he says, you know, children would say to him, I can't come to your lecture, I'm feeling a bit bipolar today. And in fact, they're kind of turning something that's being a bit sad or anxious into
being a teenager,
a mental health crisis. Which means, and actually the way of dealing with it, he says, was to give the sort of social structures and boundaries.
Let's bring in Paul Johnson now for the Institute of Fiscal Studies. Morning, Paul.
Morning.
Paul, you've been writing, really interested in column in the Times today, explaining that the way we tax people, who benefits and who are we really taxing? Is it Robin Hood taxing the rich to give to the poor?
Yeah, so we normally think about that when we look at who gets welfare benefits and pensions and so on. And obviously, particularly when you look at welfare benefits, nearly all of that goes to people on the very lowest incomes, and a lot of tax comes from high earners. So we usually, quite rightly, think of the government being very redistributive. But actually, most of what government does isn't just taking money from us and giving it straight back in benefits and so on. It's actually paying for stuff like the health service, which is by far the biggest thing government does, education, defence, police, all those sorts of things. So it's actually quite interesting and important to know what's happened over the last 30, 40 years in terms of where that money goes. And actually, that's become more redistributive over time. We're doing more of taking from the rich and giving to those on lower incomes through what we do on public services, partly because we send far more on the health service, and actually poorer people tend to have much worse health, so a lot of that money goes to them. But also effectively, when I was at university nearly 40 years ago, not that many people went to university, and it was all paid for by the taxpayer. Nowadays, far more people stay on at school, far more people go to university, and you pay yourself. That comes through the student loan system. So look over that 40, 50 year period, the state's actually got a lot more redistributive than it used to be through public services, as well, actually, as what it does through the welfare system.
And what about the so-called squeezed middle, Paul? Is there a point are there a chunk of people in the middle who get the rawest of deals?
Well, to some extent, there's been a little bit of a move back to help them in the last small number of years. When you look at the childcare changes in the budget, that's aimed at people who are in work. It's not actually aimed at poorer groups. Some of the changes that we're seeing in higher education actually are also being the new system of student loans, which comes in this year, are actually going to help somewhat higher earning graduates relative to lower earners. But people in the middle, I mean, you're right to an extent at the moment that tax increases, because they're happening through freezing personal allowances and thresholds, those tax increases are hitting people on middle kinds of incomes.
Rachel?
Hi, Paul. I'm interested in, is this partly because inequality has actually got worse, so therefore the state is having to sort of compensate more through these public services? And meanwhile, you've got sort of people with assets becoming richer and richer, if you like. Property prices have gone up, etc. Is there an element of this? This is just an inevitable result of inequality growing?
Well, I think it's partly to do with the fact that as we get richer, we want more of stuff like health. It's partly that, as you say, wealth inequality has grown, in particular over the last 30 years. So the sort of those who own their own homes are further away from those who don't. Actually, income inequality since about 1990 hasn't changed very much. The very richest, those right at the top of the income distribution, have moved away, although even that stopped over the last decade or so. The really big increases in inequality happened in the 1980s, which is quite a long time ago now. But I think this is partly just a reflection of changing sort of perceptions and needs in society, but also changing inequality in health. I mean, one of the things I think is most worrying about all this is that poorer people and less well-educated people, their health is so much worse than higher educated and better off people.
Paul, always good to speak to you. Fascinating column. Paul Johnson, Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester there. And of course, you can read them in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timeswebbox. Up next, it's the exit interviews with George Eustace.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you
everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
We've already said.
Charles George Eustace is leaving us soon.
Goodbye.
A strawberry farmer turned UKIP candidate. He campaigned against the Euro with a young Dominic Cummings.
You know, if you went on a mission with Dominic Cummings, there would always be quite a lot of casualties along the way.
He then became press secretary to Michael Howard and David Cameron.
Most of the other prime ministers we had after him, to be honest, if I saw them on television, I kind of used to fear for them.
In 2010, he was elected as Conservative MP for his hometown seat of Camborne and Redruth. He became a farming minister in 2013, resigning in 2019 in protest to Theresa May's Brexit dithering.
The sheer extent to which she allowed her government to just be buffeted about by events.
He joined the cabinet as Environment Secretary under Boris Johnson in 2020, where he often clashed with then Trade Secretary Liz Truss.
And you always had that sense, if you're trying to explain something technical and complicated to her, that she just wasn't even listening. She was just thinking about what she was going to say next.
And now he's announced he will not stand again at the next election.
In politics, the most difficult thing is you never understand until you get into it just how difficult it is to get anything done.
George Eustace, welcome to your exit interview, a chance for us both to learn what you could have done better. So, why are you leaving?
Well, I've loved my time in politics and I've enjoyed, well, not every moment of it, but most of it. It's been varied. I've had lots of different elements to my political career, but by the time of the next election, I will have done 25 years in total. The best part of 10 years as an advisor and campaigner on the No campaign and working for David Cameron and Michael Howard, and then 15 years as an MP, 9 years as a government minister, all in the same department. And I'll be 53, and I think I've got a chance to do something else in life, have a change, do something different.
Unlike so many people in politics, you had a proper job before. You're a strawberry farmer. What's the secret to growing good strawberries?
Well, growing strawberries is actually quite a nightmare to get right. Logistically, yeah, it's a huge problem. We used to employ about 300 people from about 15 different nationalities in those days. Even then, there was, yeah, migrant labour. The locals used to call it the United Nations on our farm. And it's just a very difficult logistical thing to get strawberries from a field into a punnet, refrigerated properly on a lorry, and then into a supermarket shelf without anything going wrong. And the weather is a big factor. It can affect demand. Orders collapse just when you need them to go up. Sometimes you don't have enough labour when you need it. So it's a very tricky thing to manage, and probably quite a good grounding for my time in politics.
So let's talk about your time in politics then. We'll go through some of your various bosses in politics. Your first boss in politics was probably someone called Michael Holmes, who was apparently the leader of UKIP when you stood for the party in the 1999 European elections. You lost that one. Do you ever think your political life might have been different if you'd won? Were you disappointed? Presumably you were disappointed then, but you look back now and think it might be the best thing that ever happened.
I never expected to become an MEP the moment I think I was at the bottom of the list.
Yeah.
And I can remember I didn't stay in UKIP long. I was in there long enough really to work out that it probably wasn't for me, and I left and joined the Conservatives soon after. And the reason for that is I can remember the selection for that one. And I gave quite a pitch to say that we believed in friendship with our European European neighbours, and you know, we wanted friendship with the Danes and help to support them on their Euroscepticism as well. And I gave quite a pro-European pitch for someone who actually felt we should also leave the EU. But my point was that the nation states of Europe weren't the same as the European Union. That was my underlying message. Everybody else got up and said, this is the greatest threat to our country since the Luftwaffe or Napoleon and so on and so forth. They went to the top of the list and I ended up at the bottom of the list.
You weren't too you weren't scared enough about the threat posed by you.
I think I tried to probably have too much of a too much of a clever argument about the difference between the nation states of Europe and the European Union.
Back then, if someone had said in 1999 that at some point you were going to leave the European Union, would you have believed them?
I would have thought it possible, but also unlikely. And that's because you would have needed at least one of the main political parties to have adopted that as a position. But nobody really serious was saying we should leave the EU. I mean, UKIP in 1999, that was the moment that they broke through into the public consciousness. And in that European election, actually did very well. And they, you know, they gradually built from that moment on, as did the issue.
You went on to run the No to the Euro campaign. You worked on the No to the AV campaign. You were obviously then part of the Brexit campaign. Have you ever been on a campaign which you haven't won?
Well, I don't think so, actually. It's a good point. Yes, I've had a pretty good track. I have been on some leadership campaigns that we didn't win. I won the first one when I was supporting David Cameron, but every other leadership campaign I've been on a losing side. But I did in that first, the first real proper campaign, where I really cut my teeth, to be honest, was at Business for Stirling and the No campaign. And that's when I worked with Nick Herbert, who was a very good campaigner. And also it's where Dominic Cummings and I first worked together. We were the same age. We were both at that point in our late 20s. We cut our teeth in the campaign against the Euro.
So what's your assessment of Dominic Cummings? Is he a genius or a menace?
I think he's got lots of talent, but he just cannot cope with organisation structures. I always remember when he left Business for Stirling to go to work in those days for Ian Duncan Smith. We used to call him Colonel Kurtz was his nickname. And for anybody who, you know, is too young to remember it, in the film Apocalypse Now, which was a cult 1970s film, Colonel Kurtz was a brilliant tactician, a colonel in the US Army who had all sorts of ideas for more creative tactics in Vietnam, all of which were ignored by the top brass. And he then eventually went mad, was driven insane by the bureaucracy and the structure and ended up going down a river. And that was sort of summarised, really, Dominic Cummings. He had moments of brilliance, strategic brilliance. He would always shake things up. You know, if you went on a mission with Dominic Cummings, there would always be quite a lot of casualties along the way, but he would tend to prevail and win in the end. But he can only really cope with things in short bursts, and organisation structures, boards, cabinet, those sorts of things. A big part of politics is managing a lot of other people's egos and trying to chart a way through that.
After doing all that campaign, you became head of press for the Tories in opposition under Michael Howard when he asked the country, are you thinking what we're thinking? And they replied, no.
I think actually, Michael Howard, he would have been a good prime minister in my view. I still genuinely think that. And he was a much more decent man than he's really given credit for. I remember once getting on, we were on a train station waiting to go to Newcastle somewhere. You know, Michael Howard was all the way on the train, distraught that we were rushed out by Rachel Whetstone, his advisor, rushed out of the cafe and never left a tip for the waiter in this cafe who had given us coffee. And he agonised about this all the way up. He was a very decent man. And after every party conference that's exhausting for those advisors, he used to send me a handwritten note thanking me for everything I'd done. And I think he would have been a good Prime Minister, but look, it wasn't to be, and we lost.
And I can give you the result of our exit poll, which is this election has been won by Labour, but with a majority down from 160 to 66.
So then you threw your lot with David Cameron, and you were his press secretary when he was leader of the opposition, which is when our paths first crossed. I think the first time I met you, you took me to David Cameron's house to do an interview. We did the interview in the car. The interview finished and the car pulled up at some traffic lights and you suggested I get out on a dual carriageway while you went off to get into a helicopter. Do you do that to all journalists? Abandon them on the side?
Well, we did quite often.
Dual carriageway.
We did quite often.
It makes me feel slightly better.
I know you use this in your stand-up act for several years, and I read it and I thought, I'm not sure I even recall doing that, but I have a vague recollection of that. We did used to do, the pressure on the diary was so intense that they used to do meetings and calls and interviews in the car. We probably needed to get you out of the car because he probably had some other delicate conversations to do. I thought we dropped you actually at a tube station.
No, in fact,
I ended up walking on the
King's Road trying to find a bus stop. And I had to phone somebody in the office because it was pre having maps on my phone. I didn't know where I was. And I phoned somebody in the office who got out an A to Z, and I shouted out street names until we worked out where I was.
Well, let me apologise. I never realised that it caused such long-lasting impact on you.
I've died out for a long time. And what about David Cameron? You know, tell us about what it's like when you're crisscrossing the country with the leader of the opposition.
Well, David Cameron always used to say that, you know, when I was joining him on the road, this is going to be a disaster today because George is with us, because I wasn't good on the road. Liz Sugg, who was his events manager, was far better than me at making sure everything worked to time. I remember once getting out of the car with him and taking him down the wrong road to a place where he was giving a speech, and all of the snappers and the media were at the wrong end of the other road, and so it was all missed. It's a stressful time. I can remember once he had to do a speech somewhere in the North Midlands, and in those days we tried to avoid using helicopters like the plague because he'd made such a big thing of his green credentials. But the only way he could vote in some legislation and get to this event was by helicopter. So we'd planned for him to just land somewhere discreetly, and for the local chairman to sort of pick him up, we assumed, in a Rover, and quietly take him to the event and not make a big deal about it. Little did we know that when a press officer arrived there to meet him, all of the world's media were there. Snappers, the Daily Mirror were licking their chops, because the local chairman thought he knew better and had actually alerted the world's media that there would be an arrival shot with David Cameron touching down in a helicopter. And worse than that, had also decided that he had a friend with a Bentley, and that it would look quite prime ministerial for David Cameron to step out of a helicopter and step into a Bentley. And we had to scurry around, literally with 10 minutes to go, radio to the helicopter and literally divert them to a different field somewhere else in the locality to avoid, you know, what would have been quite a spectacle.
And then you stepped back from that job because you then decided to stand as an MP yourself in the 2010 election, beating the Lib Dem Julia Goldsworthy in your home seat in Camborne and Redruth. How would it feel stepping back from being the local MP in your hometown?
It will be quite a wrench. And, you know, my family have got roots there, to say, going back 400 years. I remember I always made a big play of this in that first election, that my family's been here for 400 years. And the Mebion Curnow candidate, which is the sort of Cornish nationalists, one of them said to me, well, some of us were here before the Norman invasion. My family have been in the area a long time, but it's got Norman roots eventually at some point.
So you were born into a farming family. Then became Farming Minister, Environment Secretary. Have the Conservatives lost the support of farmers? The relationship doesn't seem that cosy at the moment.
I think it's been difficult and made worse by, you know, the body language that was coming from the government, particularly, you know, during the Liz Truss episode. It just caused a lot of anxiety in multiple areas. So green NGOs, who we'd worked quite hard to get on board, were suddenly, you know, quite alarmed by what they were hearing. You know, and farmers just felt that some of the trade deals that Liz Truss did, you know, really, you know, let down their interests. And I couldn't disagree with that. I fought very hard against some of those trade deals and fought to try and get, you know, better terms. But I think the trade deals in particular have sent quite a bad signal to sections of British agriculture. So the party's got to try and work, you know, to rekindle that trust. And I think Rishi Sunak recognises that. He's in a rural seat. He is trying to build back those bridges with farmers.
Isn't it sort of indicative of just how stuffed the Conservatives are if you've even lost farmers?
Well, it's a difficult time for us. And, you know, there is a cycle to things. And we, you know, we will at the next election be trying to win the fifth election in a row. I don't think that's ever been done, you know, in history. But nothing's inevitable in politics either. And it is, I think, still quite possible that it could be more of a 1992 election come the day rather than a 97, because Rishi Sunak's doing all the right things. There's no shortcuts. You've just got to do the hard work of making the right judgments, get the economy back in the right sort of shape. And I think the difference between 97 and now is, you know, whereas Tony Blair and his operation really looked like a government in waiting. I don't think that's the same for Keir Starmer. I don't think he's got a broad enough team around him yet, and I don't think they look like a government in waiting. And doubts could set in come the election.
Let me take you back through, George Eustace, as part of your exit interview. Let me take you through your bosses, your various managers, indeed, that you've had. And just get a one word, just sum them up in a word for us. Let's start with David Cameron.
How would you sum up David Cameron in a word?
I think he had good judgment.
Good judgment. Very good. That'll be interesting to see if you can say the same about all of these. Theresa May.
Timid.
Timid. What do you mean by timid?
I think she just was never able to take the difficult decisions, really, on Brexit. She was dealt a very difficult hand because, you know, we ended up with a hung parliament. But actually, rather than trying to reach out across party boundaries to try to build a consensus as to how to deliver Brexit, she just kept trying things that were obviously not going to get anywhere. My big frustration with her, and the reason I resigned in the end, was just the sheer extent to which she allowed her government to just be buffeted about by events.
Well, let's move on to the next person who created a lot of events. Boris Johnson, in a word.
Colourful. And Boris had strengths. He had weaknesses too. And in a funny kind of way, some of his strengths were at the same time his weaknesses. So there would be a boldness to Boris at times, and he would, you know, cut through the nonsense and get stuff done, and he'd have quite strong intuitive instincts about things and would drive things over the line in a way that some other prime ministers would always be talked out of action and would end up a bit like Theresa May, being so cautious and timid that nothing gets done. So that was his strength. But of course, you know, his tendency to throw caution to the wind is also invariably what landed him in trouble. He was also incredibly loyal to people. So he would be very loyal to ministers who, you know, came under fire or attack for things. And that's, I think, quite a good trait in a prime minister, but perhaps sometimes too loyal. And so sometimes he would stand by people when, you know, it became quite indefensible, and he would be tarnished by that.
So David Cameron, good judgment. Theresa May, timid. Boris Johnson, colourful. Liz Truss, in a word? It's broadcastable?
Ideological. And my biggest frustration is always with Liz Truss. Most of our disagreements actually were on trade. She had a very set ideological view of the world. And you always had that sense, if you're trying to explain something technical and complicated to her, that she just wasn't even listening. She was just thinking about what she was going to say next. And what she was going to say next invariably started with the words, "I'm clear that." And then it would just be the standard ideological stance that she had. And I think that's quite a dangerous trait to have, because prime ministers have got to be able to grasp detail and deal with complex issues, and they've got to bring certain nuances to policies and judgments that they make, otherwise it all comes unstuck. And I think just her inability really to listen to others and to take on board that detail was her undoing.
Do you think the British public will forgive the Conservative Party for inflicting Liz Truss on the country?
I don't know. The jury is out on that. I think there will be some people for which the Liz Truss episode, that 45 days of chaos and the fact that the party could have done that, there were good cabinet ministers who supported her, you know, to try to get a role in cabinet, and they should have known better, really, than to do that. But I think for a lot of the public, they'll think that's a point of no return, and that they will be done with the Conservatives at that, but not everyone. And so I think for a lot of others, yes, that will have damaged the reputation of the Conservatives, and people have put us, if you like, in the doghouse for now, and we're on parole and they're waiting to see. But I think it is still possible that, yes, when they see Rishi Sunak get things right and restore order, that they'll give him, you know, the benefit of the doubt and recognise that he's put things back together again.
Well, let's finish the set then. Rishi Sunak, in a word.
I think Rishi Sunak is quite close to David Cameron, and he's got good judgment. I mean, what I would say is, what I really loved about David Cameron, and I was his press secretary, is that even if he was put in a difficult interview and asked something really left field about some obscure local issue by a regional journalist,
like me,
and you, and you knew that he hadn't been briefed on it, and it was some road scheme that he might not, he could always manage it and handle it and carry it off, even if he's asked something that took him by surprise.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of the other prime ministers we had after him, to be honest, if I saw them on television, I kind of used to fear for them. I worried what they would say if they were asked something that they hadn't been told the answer to by someone in advance. And that really can't work. You know, there's a limit to what even a good press secretary can do. You've got to have somebody who's got a natural ability to do detail and to handle themselves well in a public environment. And I think Rishi Sunak has got that same sort of ability that I saw in David Cameron.
Of all of them, though, because of all the five, who was the best?
Now, that's asking, because they've all got strengths. But I would say... Well, they've all got different strengths and different weaknesses. I think from what I've said, you've got it. But I probably, because I invested so much of my time to try to get him there, would still be David Cameron. Even though it was very difficult for me because I went against him on the Brexit vote. And I don't know. I think he found it quite difficult to reconcile with that. The fact that so many old friends actually ended up on the opposite side to him, I don't think he really saw that coming.
Given that you backed it and he didn't, he said it would be a disaster, it would hit the economy, we'd spend years arguing about it, there was the upsides wouldn't be outweighed by the downsides. He was right, wasn't he? That Brexit has been a disaster.
I don't think so, because I think there's one good thing we've got, and I know there's been a lot of teething problems, that's for sure. Complicated as well by COVID in particular, but also Ukraine and all those other supply chain issues. But fundamentally, we are a self-governing country again. And I just don't think we were while we were in the EU. I was in a department where 80% of the laws came from Brussels. And most of my time was spent fretting about how we avoid infraction risks or penalties and fines from the European Union. And the department was just rubber stamping and implementing EU law. And it wasn't even possible for ministers to think creatively about what good policy would look like. And that's changed, and that's a positive.
But people will be thinking, well, being a self-governing country the size of our own laws hasn't helped with the cost of living crisis, it hasn't helped with the NHS, it hasn't helped with immigration. We took back control of our borders, and migration's at a record high. It's well, all very well and good how it's self-governing. Maybe it's the governing which is the bad thing, and it's the Conservatives.
Well, I actually genuinely think we should move on from saying this is all about Brexit and start thinking, well, have we got this policy right or wrong? So if you look at trade policy, I've been critical of the Australia trade deal. I think we could have done much better. But at least we're free to have a trade policy, whereas in the EU it was unlawful for you to have your own trade policy. You weren't allowed to do that. You can argue about immigration policy. As it happens, I'm somebody who'd have a more liberal approach on immigration. I would allow so-called tier 3 unskilled labour to come in on 3-year visas. I think this skills-based immigration policy it isn't actually working. We should have a needs-based policy where we allow in people we need in the sectors where there are shortages.
Like working on strawberry farms.
In the food industry, yeah. Strawberry farms, care homes, the consequences of having labour shortages in these critical sectors is quite acute. And I would therefore have a needs-based approach to immigration rather than a skills-based approach. But that's at least we can have that argument.
You sound more like Keir Starmer than Rishi Sunak.
Well, I think at least we can have that argument, yeah. And we should have that debate. And that's what it should be like as a self-governing country. Yeah. You won't get everything right. And when you make mistakes, you're able to put it right and correct it. Whereas in the EU, you never even had that right. And that's a positive. I mean, coming back to David Cameron, he was never an enthusiast for the EU. He and Oliver Letwin were sometimes referred to as secret outers in that they weren't passionate about the European Union. I just think the difference between them and me is he felt, and probably was right about this, that it would just be quite a hassle trying to leave, and it would be difficult and complicated, and and would take years to unpick. And he was proved right on that one.
And I suppose, I always thought that was the strongest argument, the massive faff. The lost opportunity, the fact that all parliaments debated for years and years was the process of getting out rather than reforming schools or hospitals or the environment or whatever it might be. And we'll never get back those lost years, will we?
No, and they were tedious years. The parliament of 2017 to 2019 in particular, a hung parliament, the deal between us and the DUP to try to keep the show on the road, government losing votes left, right and centre all the time, the parliament hijacking the order paper. It was an absolute nightmare to try to deal with that. And I really think parliament failed to rise to the challenge. And a lot of people, kind of went off the rails. I mean, there are a lot of MPs who, went a little bit, I think, mad would be the wrong word, but close to it, through the difficulties of that time. And many of them chucked the towel in and quit politics in 2019.
What's been the best part of your job as your time as an MP?
Well, I think as an MP rather than a minister, there's nothing more satisfying than when you manage to get an outcome for an individual constituent that's got problems. And so I've helped people whose house had, you know, partly fallen down mine shafts and drainage holes, and they couldn't get insurance, and we've intervened and managed to sort those problems out for them. I've had people who had real problems getting the right benefit support or the right housing, and we've helped get their lives back on track. And there are thousands of cases like that where we've just helped people in their everyday life, and it's really satisfying when you can do that. And then as a minister, you know, really I've got three flagship bills or acts of parliament now, and the Fisheries Act, the Agriculture Act and the Environment Act. I was closely involved in designing all three of those.
When you were Environment Secretary, were you responsible for plastic straws?
Yes, I was.
Could you not have written a law which meant that paper straws had to be thick enough to finish your drink?
I have thought the same myself. And sometimes the paper straws aren't good enough to pierce a carton in the old way.
No, I think that law needs revisiting.
I'm sure they will improve this. It was actually done, I was in the department at the time, it was done during the tenure of Michael Gove.
Of
course. Something that we were pushing forward.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of progress has been made
on
some of those new restrictions on plastics.
Would you recommend it to a friend?
Yeah, I would. And I've absolutely no regrets about it. And I think I've been quite fortunate in that I've seen it from lots of different perspectives. Yeah. I saw opposition. I was involved in a campaign group. I was press secretary to David Cameron when he was on his way to Downing Street. And yeah, that was an incredible thing to be part of. Very hard work, but an incredible thing to be part of. And I've, you know, been through politics and, you know, left, you know, several acts of parliament to my name. So yes, it's very varied. You can't get bored. There's different issues. If you get bored of an issue, then you can champion a different one. You learn something new every week because people bring all sorts of obscure, difficult problems to you. And even now, you know, new problems come my way on things that I haven't encountered before. So it's very varied, very rewarding when you get an outcome. And it's got lots of frustrations, but I think every job has its fair dose of frustrations. And in politics, the most difficult thing is you never understand until you get into it just how difficult it is to get anything done. You know, you think when you're a candidate that when you're an MP, you'll be able to get things done. And then when you're an MP, you still can't get much done. You can do debates and you can push things and push amendments, but you hope that when you're a minister, you'll get things done. And then you still actually really struggle to get things done. And it's only really when you become a Secretary of State that you can really start to drive stuff over the line. But even then, it's very frustrating. You have to have arguments with cabinet colleagues to get things done.
Who did you have the biggest argument with?
Liz Truss, without a shadow of doubt. But we regularly also had arguments with the Home Office in particular over immigration policy.
Final question then, George Eustace. In your exit interview, as you leave us, what will you do next?
I don't know. I'm taking a leap of faith, but I've always done that. You know, I left David Cameron's office without really knowing what I was doing next, except apart from thinking I'd like to try for a seat. And I left the No campaign not knowing whether I'd get another job in politics, and I managed to work for Michael Howard. And this time, my aim really would be to try and work in agri-food or agri-tech. I've got 9 years' experience in that sector through the government department that I was in. I developed quite a lot of technical knowledge in those sectors over that time, and I'd quite like to stay involved in that industry. So that would be my aim. But for now, I've still got another year plus to do of this role, and obviously got plenty to be getting on with.
Well, George Eustace, Conservative MP, thanks very much for joining us for your exit interview.
Thank you.
Interview on the podcast next week. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, is goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.